I'm going to call this meeting to order. This is the July 10th meeting of the Central Marine Sanitation Agency Commission. First up is Pledge of Allegiance. Would you all still, all please join me?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Kay, would you please call the roll?
Certainly. Diane Burst, here. Mary Beth Bushy,
here.
Dean DiGiovanni,
here.
Michael Borstein,
here.
Thomas Gaffney,
here.
And Dan Hillman,
here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is agenda item number 3, open period for public participation. This is the time we have set aside for members of the public to speak on anything not on tonight's agenda. You will have up to 2 minutes. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak? Seeing none, we will move on. Next up is consent calendar. Matters under the consent calendar item are routine and will be enacted by one motion. Any member of the public, staff, or the council, the commission, can pull an item for discussion. Would anybody like to pull an item? I see none, so I will entertain a motion to pass 4A through 4I.
So moved. I'll second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. I believe that was unanimous. Agenda item number 5, fiscal year 2018-19 Commission Officers, Finance Committee, and North Bay Watershed Association Board Appointments.
Okay, thank you. So this is a annual event for the board, usually done in July, where they appoint officers of the board. We'll nominate and appoint officers of the board, the chair, the vice chair, and the secretary. Then we also have one standing committee, that's the finance committee. So we nominate and select people for the committee, and that's 3 board members. And that could be a sitting board member or an alternate board member from one of the member agencies. And then we have 2 representatives that the board appoints to the North Bay Watershed Association's board of directors. One is the primary representative, and one is the alternate. And the way we've done this in the past is we usually have nominations and appointments, you know, one position at a time. And that's it.
Thank you. Any questions or comments to start off with? Okay. Any member of the public like to speak to this? All right. Let's bring it back and start working on some nominations.
Well, I nominate Diane first for commission chair.
Second. Okay. I accept the.
I'm going to close nominations.
Second.
Any other nominations?
No,
we
closed.
Okay, we're closed. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you very much. Appreciate that. For vice chair,
Tom Gaffney.
Second.
You know, I'm going to be off the board in probably in a month. We rotate board members every 2 years.
Who will be joining us?
Probably Doug. Oh. We don't know yet. We don't know yet.
Might be interested. And vice chair?
Yeah.
Or instead sure. Dean, be interested?
Yeah. Good.
Okay, I'd move Michael for commission vice chair.
Second.
Any other nominations? Dean?
I'm fine with Michael.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor to appoint Michael as vice chair?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed?
I nominate Dean for second chair.
Second.
You willing to do that?
Just have to sign all the papers.
That's for Al, I'll do it.
Okay, all in favor to appoint Dean as secretary?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Thank you. Thank you, Dean. All right, Standing Finance Committee. Tom, Michael, and Dean.
I move that we keep it the same.
Yeah, I'd like to serve on
the committee. Yeah, we can do that without being on the commission.
But you can be maybe an alternate?
That's
right.
That's
how
that
works?
Yeah, I'm an alternate. Yeah.
Okay.
I will be an alternate.
Okay. unless anybody else would like to suggest a change?
I'm fine with that, because Lindy's good team.
Okay, so all in favor of Tom, Michael, and Dean remaining on the Finance Committee?
Aye.
Any opposed? No? Good. North Bay Watershed Association. I've been doing it. Michael?
Like it?
I do like it, but I'm kind of really swamped these days. It's difficult for me, and I'm job hunting, and I don't know what my work situation will be in the near future.
Would anybody else like it? Because I can do it through RVSD. And they end up doing that anyway also.
That might not...
How about, sure, I'll do it from here. And if anything changes, we'll figure it out then.
I can imagine a big conflict of interest. It's an informational voluntary association.
Well, it is, but they do vote on like the budget and the minutes. You know, so they do take votes. So we probably want both organizations represented, even if it's just a matter of...
As long as Jason's the alternate, it should work.
What do you think, Jason? Wouldn't we want somebody from West Valley and somebody from CMSA?
I would think that that board would want two separate people representing each district. It might be, you know, an issue that they would deal with
somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll do it.
Excuse me. Okay, and we can always revisit that if it works out that you... there was no meeting last week due to the 4th of July holiday, so the meeting's this Friday, but you probably know that.
Yes.
Okay, all in favor of naming Michael as the representative on North Bay Watershed Association with Jason as the alternate?
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Okay.
Now, I have one comment. In our board, the standing committees get compensation the same as the board members. And at least for me, I know all three of us. I'd like to put on an agenda item in the future that we get compensation for standing committees, like $100 or whatever it is. But I'd like it as an agenda item in the future.
That's fair.
Yeah, we have a board compensation policy. And it says board members receive $100 per day of service. So if it's multiple meetings in a day, it's only $100. Yeah. And you can have up to 6 meetings in a month, for service. And specific in that policy, when it was prepared at the time, the board said that standing and ad hoc committee members wouldn't receive any compensation. But we could, like at the next meeting agenda in August, we could bring that policy back for the board to revisit that.
August or September?
Yeah.
And how many meetings would the Finance Committee have? We had a number of them last year, but that was for the 5-year.
Yeah, normally, in a regular year, we usually meet the Finance Committee once in May to review the draft proposed budget for the upcoming fiscal year. This last year was an exception because we had the development of the multi-year revenue plan. And it's likely this next fiscal year will be an exception because we're going to do kind of the planning for a debt issuance in fiscal year 20.
So two.
Yeah, probably 2 or 3 meetings this coming fiscal year.
Okay, I think that's fair. So we'll bring it back.
Okay, so we'll bring that.
Good. Moving on. Agenda item number 6, participation in the Marine Clean Energy Deep Green Program. Jason?
Thank you. So CMSA is a member of the MC Light Green Program, and the board has considered participation in the Deep Green program a few times in the past, the most recently last month. And that was a good discussion we had. The board reviewed, the estimated cost for the agency's participation based on an estimate was from the end of April 2017 through the end of April 2018. That was about $3,200. And that it'd be more than that if we had some extensive, major maintenance on the cogen engine where we're exclusively buying power for, like a month or two time period. But on a normal year, when there's regular maintenance and it's offline, it'd be, at least based on that estimate, around $4,000 or so. And the board also had a discussion about, the emissions of deep green being zero all the time, and also, the profile of when a customer's demand might be different than what the renewable supply is, and how is that made up, and the dynamics of that, and also a little discussion on their certification as reported on the MCU website. So at the conclusion of that discussion, there's a lot of public comment during that also. The board took action to continue the item to tonight's meeting and presented four questions that I noted. And after the meeting, I forwarded those on to MCE, Ms. Chris Kubrick, who's here in the audience. And she provided, you know, responses to the board's questions. So the board's questions are on page one of the staff reports. Then there are several attachments. The first attachment is Ms. Kubrick's response to those questions. And so that's really been the staff report. Staff is just looking for a board decision on, do you want to join Deep Green program, not join it, or ask staff to do some other type of follow-up activity. And Ms. Kubrick could answer any questions or clarify any of the responses that she provided to the board's four questions from last month.
Thank you. Any questions of Jason or Ms. Kubrick? Mary Beth.
Questions. Thank you so much for your answers. We had a really specific factual scenario in mind that you didn't seem to have addressed. So if you could talk to us about that, that would be great.
Sure.
As you might know, we have a very large low profile here driven by our pumping, which often occurs during storms in the winter. And often at night when it's dark and we're thinking that there's not a lot of renewable energy available.
Right.
So that was the factual scenario that we were trying to understand.
Sure.
How, because this could be, you know, our peak load.
Yes.
Would be happening at that time.
Yes. That's a great question. I attempted to address it in this document, but sometimes it's a confusing thing to consider. So MCE is responsible for generation. So our job for our customers is to interconnect generation sources onto the grid through the CAISO. So there's a system that I'm sure you're familiar with to some extent for us to do that. PG&E, our very close partner, is responsible for distribution. And they're responsible for the distribution grid. So they're responsible for making sure that everything is delivered across those high voltage lines of transmission, as well as the delivery lines going straight into your homes and into your businesses that you're very familiar with. So the we're both responsible for resource adequacy to make sure there's a 15% buffer on what we're loading onto the grid and what they're delivering so that there's no risk of brownouts and blackouts. But as we know, you know, electricity is a function of physics, and those electrons are going to flow from the nearest source. So whatever the nearest source is the electrons you're going to get through the distribution grid. They're not going to be related to generation unless, for example, you have solar generation on your roof, et cetera, that you're using behind the meter. That would be direct electrons from. Otherwise, you're probably getting it from the solar array over at the Cost Plus. That's one of our feed-in tariffs. It's probably one of the closest sources over here. So that's kind of how it works. Everybody's probably familiar with that. So the question is, it's a great question. A lot of people ask this, is how, if you're only supplying solar and wind in Deep Green, well, how are we getting it? Well, first of all, remember that generation, whether PG&E is doing the generation or we're doing the generation responsibility is to deliver it onto the grid. But the electrons are being delivered from, on the basis of physics, to the nearest source. That's how that works. So the relationship between the solar and the wind really is a contractual relationship on the basis of the billing relationship we have with you on a monthly basis. And we match the supply of those contracts that we have mapped into Deep Green from California sources that are GREENY certified to the purchase of the aggregate of residents, public sector, and commercial who are purchasing it. So last year we sold 107 gigawatt hours of Deep Green, and we purchased 107 gigawatt hours of Deep Green. This year we're forecasting 178 gigawatt hours of Deep Green, and we are making sure that we're purchasing and mapping that amount of solar and wind. You know, back in 2016, we really wanted to be able to answer a question like this differently, because a lot of people, whether they're knowledgeable about energy or not knowledgeable about energy, do like the idea of load shaping the supply to the demand. So we had to kind of do a trade-off because we did have biogas in Deep Green in 2016, which allowed us to have more base load in there. But because we also want to be Deep Green or Greeny certified, because that is very valuable to a lot of entities who want to feel assured that we're doing what we're saying we're doing, Greeny made a decision after 2016 that they weren't going to allow any sources that produce emissions in the process of producing that generation. And they told us we could no longer include biogas, which, frankly, we were very unhappy about because we wanted to be able to answer your question differently because customers like demand and supply to be shaped similarly because it gives them a comfort level. It's very conceptually comfortable. So we chose to continue with Deep Green or with Greeny certification, but we look at it on an annual basis because there are strengths and weaknesses to both approaches. We could stop doing Greeny certification and we could shape Deep Green to look like the demand. But so far we've chosen not to because we think the certification is very important to a lot of our customers. So that's a simple answer. I don't want to go on for too long, but you may have follow-up questions. I'd be happy to attempt to answer those.
So what I'm gathering is that on a January night when we're having our peak loads, the electricity serving our plant will not be renewably sourced.
Your electrons don't have a red jacket or a blue jacket or a green jacket. Your electrons are really just physics. You're always being delivered by the closest generation source, regardless of who your contractual relationship is with. That's just how that is. But the contract that you have with us that we're selling to you through the PG&E bill is the Deep Green of solar and wind, which are producing on an annual basis. But yes, they're not producing at midnight in January. They're not. So it takes a bit of a, you know, conceptual, I mean, there are a lot of arrangements, I think, that we have with our financial arrangements, where we have a financial arrangement in one place, and then we have a delivery of cash in another place. So it's something that, you know, I don't know if you can be comfortable with it. It may be something that just doesn't really make sense to you from you for you.
Well, I'm just trying to understand the facts because you represent in this chart that we go from an emissions of 90,000 pounds of CO2 to zero.
Yeah.
But based on your example of, you know, when our peak load might occur, that's not a factually accurate representation.
Well, the way that these regimes work, you know, renewable energy is subject to so many different regimes of what people have made decisions about, you know, how they define resource adequacy, how they define scope 2 emissions. So scope 2 emissions are defined as electricity use in buildings. And electricity use in buildings is defined very easily by the kWh used, and then it is accounted for by the source. Production, the generation source. So we didn't create that. It's not our idea. You know, those ideas have been out in the marketplace for decades, and there are various organizations which allow entities who either choose voluntarily to or are required to report their emissions. So some entities report scope 1 emissions, which are the generation emissions. Some entities report scope 2, which is electricity use in buildings. Some actually go to the trouble of reporting scope 3, which is pretty complicated because it's employees driving to work. It's probably me coming here tonight, etc. So, you know, I can't really defend scope 2 emissions, but it's part of the regime of renewable energy, which has all kinds of probably strange ways of doing things to the average reader. You're welcome.
Any other questions? None? All right. Let's open it up for public comment. Is there any members of the public who would like to speak? Why don't you just either stand up right where you are, if it's a small room, you're fine.
Can you all hear me?
Mm-hmm. But if we could keep it to 3 minutes, please.
Oh, it would be much less than that.
Thank you
very much. Some of you might know that I'm a candidate for office, but right now I'm talking to you as a fellow who a few years ago is my first year of retirement from work. I rode a bicycle across the country to raise awareness to global warming, climate change, and things we need to do. And, you know, folks all across the country kind of get this idea that we need to address this issue, even people in conservative parts of the country. And I know that our kids really get it. And if you all make the right decision tonight, they'll appreciate it. And I think that decision is to go with the deep green. The way I look at your question, is it Bushy, is that who?
Yeah. Mary Beth Bushy from Center
Mary, Hall. There you go. Maybe in the midwinter, deep green's not providing all the energy, but on a nice hot July afternoon, it's reducing what PG&E has to produce. So when you look at it annually, PG&E is cutting back production because renewables are producing more, much more. Okay, so that's the way it can balance out on a yearly basis and why this system will work. So I think you should go for it. I happen to live in Santa Venetia. I'm reading here that my sanitary district has just recently done this, and I think you'll all be really happy, and your kids or your grandkids will be thrilled about it in a couple of years after you hear about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anybody else?
Yes, I'd like to comment, please. My name is Norma Fragoso, and I'm a resident in Fairfax and also a program director for the Environmental Forum of Marin. And I'm here today because I'm extremely concerned about our planet and the environment and the detrimental impact of greenhouse gas emissions, which foul the air, warm the oceans, and create an unlivable and unsustainable environment for generations to come. I know CMSA generates its own electricity, and you should be very proud of that. You have been a leader, I understand, in the community. However, I'm here to ask you to take one more regional leadership step and taking this opportunity to opt up for the deep green electrical services for the upcoming fiscal year. By opting for deep green, you would, as the board member indicated, would reduce your greenhouse gases to zero, your emissions to zero. How incredible is that? Along with helping the rest of the county to reduce emissions, but also you would continue to set the standard and an example for all other agencies. As you know, there is an effort. All the municipal cities and towns and the county have opted for deep green, and now we're looking at the local districts to do the same. So an effort to reduce the emissions that cause global warming and so many other problems that come under the topic of global warming. So please vote to opt to deep green. I know there is an expense involved, but in terms of the savings of having to pay for other sources of energy and the benefit to the community, I hope you can find it in your budgets to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anybody else?
Yes, my name is Tom Flynn. I live in Larkspur. My field is environmental management, and I just feel we face very, very serious problems with climate change. And the fact is that we have solutions, viable solutions to these problems of extreme weather and the spread of diseases from warm areas to the northern hemisphere. And there's a lot of problems we're potentially leaving to the next generations. And I just feel it's a matter of conscience to take advantage of these viable solutions when we have them available, such as deep green. And, CMSA has been a renewable energy leader in generating your own power, and you've set a great example with the Food to Energy program. I'm truly grateful for your leadership in this. And by opting into Deep Green, you show continued leadership in sustainability and environmental protection. And in addition to reducing your greenhouse gas emission to zero, you'll be helping the communities of Marin and the state reach their climate action goals. And lastly, 50% of the premium that you pay for Deep Green is an investment in renewable and local renewable energy sources like the Cooley Quarry and the Solar One project in Richmond. So it is an investment in the future, and ultimately it's going to pay good returns. So please support Deep Green in your vote today. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to speak?
Yes, I would. Hi, everyone. My name is Chance Catrano, and I'm with the Sierra Club of Marin. Last year was the 125th anniversary of the Sierra Club, and for that special occasion, we launched our Ready for 100 campaign, which focuses on getting cities, towns, municipalities around the entire country to make these bold commitments that me and other people really will count on as I age, as we all age, and address some of these really challenging problems. I sit on a national climate adaptation task force, and it's not looking very good. You know, it looks more and more difficult as we start to really look at these numbers, and we're realizing that these incremental steps, even though they seem inconsequential, they're cumulative and they multiply, and these types of decisions that we make here tonight are the things that really put us on a better path for the future. So on behalf of the over 5,700 members of the Sierra Club here in Marin County, I urge you all to take this step into the future with MCE and opt up to 100% renewable with Deep Green. Thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else? Seeing none, let's bring it back for conversation and deliberation. Anybody want to volunteer to start?
Yeah, sure. Nothing is perfect, especially in our world. In 2001, I pretty much bought the first Toyota Prius off the line here in Marin County. And I still have it. Well, I don't know that my sister owns it. And it certainly wasn't perfect. It's been through three sets of batteries in its 250,000 miles so far lifetime. And that's not particularly green. But they get good mileage, and I think it's because of that Toyota Prius that we're seeing all of the new hybrids, all of the electric vehicles that are happening. And although they haven't been perfect along the way, we're headed in that direction. And even though this, MCAE may not be able to, throughout the dead of winter, in the biggest of our storms when we're doing 130, million gallons through the system here, and it's dark and we haven't produced any alternative thing, in years to come, it's only going to get better. Just as my Prius, which is still on the road, the new Priuses are better mileage, better batteries, and we have Teslas, and now everything, so I would be not so concerned. So I would be in favor of doing this.
Thank you. Tom?
Well, I kind of agree with Michael. It doesn't have to be perfect. It has to be as good as you can do under the circumstances. I think it'd be... the explanations were difficult to follow. And maybe that's one of the things. I understand what it is. You produce the amount of energy from your solar and your wind energy that you contract for. The timing isn't the same, but you do produce the energy. And so that's, I think, something we should go for. I do support a full green.
Thank you. Dan?
I support taking the action tonight, mainly because look forward to seeing half of the revenue stream go to a reinvestment of local cogen sources. I think that's the prime directive and the prime lesson everybody should be getting on board, is getting those sources closer to the user. And anything we can do to encourage that, I think that's a good thing. So I want to also comment that I found the descriptions a bit hard to follow, but I get the drift, and the cost benefits here for me.
Thank you. Very good.
I agree in concept with Dan. We should invest everything that we can to getting generation available in Marin. And I believe CMSA is in a unique position in the entire county in that we actually produce energy. And instead of investing only 50% in making energy in Marin County, I think we should invest 100%. And the best way to do that is to, instead of investing money in the 50% program at Marin Clean Energy, we should invest it in our own program and make more renewable energy here.
Thank you. Dane?
I'm very much in support of renewable energy. Wish I could do it at my house, but I'm just on the wrong side of the hill. I wish I could put a wind turbine up, but I can't. But we, as Mary Beth stated, we are in a great position here because we are like one of the only generators in San Rafael. We have a power plant right here, and we are 93% generating our own power. And if you tack on the 50% in the light green of the power we do buy, we're up to about 96, 97% of renewable right here, what we're doing right now. I would like to see and Jason, maybe you can explain just to the audience and to the rest of the board or commissioners what sort of where we're sitting and how fast we're moving towards getting closer to that 100% with our own generators and bringing on even a second generator and selling actually as a generator to MCE.
And wouldn't that be the outcome in any event, no matter what we do this evening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the plan.
Yeah. Yes and no. I mean, it is a token amount, $3,500. That's $3,500 that we invest in ourselves and into the future marketing and getting more food waste. And, you know, just like Marin Clean Energy sets up a little till, a little bank account that they're pushing 50% of the premium into, we, in essence, have our own little bank account to put our 100% of that into for our future development. And I think, yes, we would be doing it anyway, Dan, you're 100% correct. But
I understand.
Philosophically, that's where I'm
there's another issue which we're going to be discussing a little bit later, where we're going to be doing a study here where there may be some issues about actually the amount that our digesters can deal with. And we may, we don't know yet, but we may have some difficulties at some point going over a certain amount if our digesters can't handle it, and that'll be discussed a little bit later. So I think we should, on all fronts, what we can do here, and supporting clean energy in general, everything.
Yes, Dan, then I'd like to give Jason a chance to describe kind of
when we
plans.
Hit the tipping point and start becoming an exporter, wouldn't we be recovering that 30 whatever it is $100?
Well, once we're exporting, we're not buying any power,
right?
Yeah,
we're making money using that as a token amount is really just kind of that's how this starts, but we end up going hitting a tipping point and becoming an exporter.
Yes, there's I'll try to be brief to answer Commissioner D.J.'s question. So there's three phases to our power delivery plan. The first is to become energy self-sufficient. And we're anywhere from, you know, 92 to 97% there, depending on the amount of organic material that comes in. Once we achieve that, the second phase is to utilize all the available capacity in the existing cogeneration system. And that's, you know, 3/4 of a megawatt. And that's what we have under contract with MCE to sell above plant demand needs to the cogen capacity. Then the third phase is utilizing all the additional digestion capacity within the anaerobic digesters. So in the first phase, what we've done is we have an interconnection agreement with PG&E that will allow us to export once some improvements are made. We have the power purchase agreement with MCE at a really good, you know, purchase price. We have completed the, you know, electrical system studies by PG&E to see what improvements they need to make to their system to allow us to deliver power. And we found out that those improvements were made by other entities, so they don't have to make them to their transmission distribution system, which is a good thing. And then we have to make some improvements to our, you know, electrical system here at the agency. One, you know, in the cogeneration system, then at the main, you know, power, you know, receiving and delivery switchgear building. That's been a slow-moving process. You know, we've set aside the money to pay PG&E for various improvements, and we've hired Crowell engineers to deal with the electrical design for our system. But it's been very iterative with PG&E that we'll submit, you know, the electrical design drawings. They'll look at it, then they'll provide some comments. We'll make, you know, revisions. Then they'll provide comments later that should have been done the first time. They have to go back and make more revisions. So that's taken probably 6 months longer than we had anticipated based on PG&E's estimate. So looking forward, you know, the revenue meter for delivery, we don't need one of those because our existing meter is fine. The SCADA system improvements they need, the reclosure system, are already there. The ground fault detection bank, which we set aside $45,000 for them to replace. They sent out some additional engineering staff to look at that, to make a determination if it's fine or not. They don't know, so they're going to have to shut down their system, and we'll shut down our system, and they'll see what happens if it's, you know, there's a ground fault. So all of those are kind of happening. So once the design's approved by PG&E, determinations are made on the ground fault detection bank. We bring in, you know, another contractor we have already under contract to do programming of relays and install various, you know, improvements based on PG&E's approval. We'll be ready here. They're ready there. And then we'll have a commercial operations date, you know, authorization from them with a date certain that we can begin to deliver power. That could be as early as the end of September, or it could be months beyond that. We don't have a good estimate. So that's just the ability to deliver power. So once that happens, we'll need to look at expanding the organic waste program. We're holding off on that until we have a date kind of planned when we can get the authorization from PG&E. Then we have staff, and they'll start, you know, identifying. And the EPA has a website that has a lot of information on it for these different types of, you know, businesses that produce materials that have some organic waste byproduct. We need to identify those, talk to them, and try to recruit them to bring the material here for digestion and more power, biogas generation and more power generation. You know, that may take another year from now before we're energy self-sufficient and delivering some power. And what Commissioner Borson was talking about, as part of our facilities master plan, one of the 11 tasks was performing a biogas utilization study. And that was looking at how we could utilize the biogas capacity in the digester for those phase three, after we're energy self-sufficient and delivering all the power that we can from the existing cogenerator. And there's a lot of additional capacity in the digesters, which is great. But what, you know, the engineering, you know, process consultants have told us, that there have been, you know, a handful of national studies that show, and this kind of gets kind of technical, but in essence that the fat oils in Greece, which the studies was based on, the what they call volatile solids loading of that in relation to the wastewater solids loading has a certain amount before you upset the microorganisms in the digester. And the digester can have health issues, kind of like your stomach, and get upset and produce gases, bad gases. And it's a big mess to clean that up. So they've told us that's around 30% based on the fat soils and grease studies. Well, we've told them, well, you know, the mixture that we feed the digesters is food waste and the fog. So it kind of, you know, balances out some of the low pH of the fog, which can affect the pH and the health of digesters. So you think, well, you know, they're not quite sure about that. So part of the study was, okay, energy self-sufficiency, that's like a 36% ratio, 36% loading from the organics, the volatile solids. to be energy self-sufficient, you're at 42% loading. To utilize all your digest capacity, it's something like 63% loading. Right now, with peak material coming in, we're generating 24 hours a day for, like, you know, multiple days during the week, we might be up, you know, in the low 30s, above what they recommend just based on the fog. But we haven't experienced any digester, you know, upset issues. So to figure out what that actual threshold is, at least on a lab scale pilot bench scale basis, we're going to, and I won't talk about this with our business plan, I'm telling you now, that we're going to set up, you know, a control digester in the lab and a test digester, and we're going to start increasing the non-food waste loading to the test digester, because we don't expect Marin Sanitary Service to increase rapidly the food waste program. It'll be other organic waste streams, and see at what volatile solids loading rate and percentage relative to the other, you know, feedstocks do we experience a problem. Say it's, which we grade like 47%, say it's that, then we'll start feeding more material to just one of the digesters to test that. And then there's various, you know, lab analyses that you can perform to see if you're trending to a bad place for the digester. So that's something that's in the business plan, to scope out that study and to build the digesters, develop a plan, and, you know, implement that this year. And Corollo Engineers is going to partner with us on that at no cost to the agency, so we can, you know, hopefully get some good results and issue paper together on the food waste fog mixture. So the future amount of power, you know, supply to the system will be dependent on the results of that study. That's all I'll say.
So September of next year is what I'm gathering is we'll be selling electrons back into the grid.
Hopefully, yeah. And we'll have the answer from the study on what's the most we could ever distribute.
So we have been working for the 2 years that I've been on this board, you know, very diligently, and we spent a lot of money carefully to see if we can generate extra energy to sell, of course, to MCE. And, you know, that's where we're investing our money. And I think we supported that unanimously for no return.
Mary Beth, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to ask, it sounds like from your explanation that when we figure out the ratio of food waste and fog, that there might be a need to go out and procure whatever the needed, to ensure that the needed ratio is occurs. So we might need to go out and recruit new restaurants to participate in the food to energy program, for example. And these might create additional costs, that it might be nice to have $3,000 a year to contribute towards that sort of management. And it also occurs to me that dovetails exactly with what Tom just said about all the investment that we've made in this system. And are continuing. It sounds like we're not quite there yet. But we've got to. We're probably a year away from getting the system up and running. And we need to invest more money. And we can invest it. I remain in favor of investing in our system and creating energy here in Marin.
Thank you. More comments? I'll have my turn.
Well, I'll reduce mine. It's clearly not an economics judgment. It's a decision to help send a message about what it is we're doing together. I recognize the economics of this or not. The money's clearly, if we reinvest it, we're pursuing the same goals, but we're doing it with a different message about our partners. So I want to be clear that I'm supporting this because the message we're sending about working together with other energy aware groups in the county to send a message about getting power close to the source. And we're a good example. I think we can join together. We're soon going to be a self-sufficient and an exporter. So it's mainly a political message we're sending by taking this action. And I'll be upfront about that. And I still think it's worth it. I agree with the economics analysis. But I'm just, it's a public affairs message for undecided to send by acting tonight. And those that don't want to send that message, I respect it.
Okay. Well, I was going to say actually exactly that. It's speaking with our money. But it is a small amount considering how much energy this plant uses, and obviously we've discussed at length the fact that we generate the vast majority of our energy that we need in this plant. But the money does speak. And this agency, with the other agencies in the county, all the cities, the county, other agencies and homeowners and businesses throughout the state and the country are speaking and saying they want renewable energy. And that is what a switch to deep green will do. It will say, we want the energy that we use to come from a green source. Now, I understand that the actual electrons we're getting at night during a storm in January are not necessarily going to be an actual electron from an actual solar panel, but that is an issue that at this moment in time we cannot overcome due to technological limitations, the way the grid operates, and it's not MCE's responsibility to be able to solve that right now. As we, as a society, generate more and more solar and wind, I think we, hand in hand with that, will come better solutions to store that energy or other solutions to take up the slack at night. But we are not quite there yet. But we can make a decision to go deep green to make this plant 100% renewable. Even though down the road, you know, a year from September when we are, you know, generating 100%, more than 100% of what this plant needs, there might be some instances where we have to, you know, shut down the cogen generator and we need to pull a little something off the grid. It would be nice for this agency to be able to say it's 100% renewable. Every city and the county has done it. Many other agencies here in the county has done it. The people of this county support it, and I think they would support us using our funds, a very modest amount of funds, to also support renewable energy. So, if nobody else has anything else to say, I will entertain a motion.
I move that we recommend that CMSA participate in the MCE Deep Green program.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. There's a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Any abstentions? Okay, that was 4-2. Thank you. And thank you all for coming and speaking.
Thank you.
It's nice to see some new faces.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Not alone when you say the pledge.
Thank you for your work.
Okay, moving on to the fiscal year 19 agency business plan. Jason.
Okay, so the agency strategic planning committee prepared the fiscal year 18 business plan report, and concurrent to doing that, they prepared the proposed fiscal year 19 plan. The report for last year's plan was accepted by the board, you know, at the June board meeting, and tonight attached to the staff report is the proposed fiscal year 19 plan. So in the plan before you, there are, so we have six agency-wide goals, then there's supporting objectives. So in this plan, there's 23 objectives, seven of those are new, and those are ones listed on the staff report in the middle. And there are 93 different actions, which are the projects and tasks and activities to support the objectives to align with the goal. And there are about 93 of those, and 68 are new. And the others are either in progress, still, or they're kind of ongoing, or they happen each year. So just briefly regarding the new objectives, just I'll mention these real quick. So one is delivering projects from the facilities master plan. So there's five projects in the business plan that were from the master plan. Then, you know, we have a pretty old, you know, financial software system here called OSAS. So this year, the new objective will be to do a needs assessment of, financial needs assessment of, you know, the agency, then to evaluate the current software, financial software, and other software packages, utilizing a consultant expert to see, you know, and perform a gap analysis with the current software and which softwares can, you know, meet the financial needs based on the assessments. And then based on what we find, we'll come to the board with, you know, maybe a recommendation to just purchase some new modules for the existing software or to purchase a new software package. So that's an objective with quite a few actions below it. Then, as we briefly talked about earlier, there's an objective to plan and prepare for a debt issuance in fiscal year 20. So that'd be pulling the finance committee together, you know, probably halfway through this fiscal year, look at what projects to bundle into a debt issuance. And a lot of that has already been done in the development of the revenue plan. And then to look at, you know, do we want to keep the same bond counsel, underwriting counsel, financial advisors, and have a nice plan prepared for the board to consider. And that come to the board sometime later in the fiscal year, the board approve that. Then we look at issuing debt the following fiscal year per the revenue plan timing. Then there's aligning, you know, our fixed assets in the financial system with the computerized maintenance management system. They're kind of been done different ways. So we realize that we need to look at all the fixed assets in the CMS system, which is pretty accurate, make sure those are accurately reflected in the financial system, remove assets that have been replaced in the past, ones that are obsolete, look at the service life of the assets for depreciation purposes, and make sure we have a policy and procedure in place. That way, when we retire equipment, it's removed from both systems. When we procure new equipment, it's included in both systems as appropriate. And as we, you know, repair systems and invest in something to extend its service life, that we make those changes in the financial system. So there's that. Then there's the volatile solids loading study for the digesters. We talked about that a length a minute ago. Then what we've talked about also is CMSC implementing the environmental laboratory accreditation standards. And the first piece of that was hiring an additional staff person, the lab analyst, and that person starts on Monday. And then it'll be like an 18-month process to make sure our lab policies and procedures and work practices align with the new ELAB standards that are in development right now. And our lab director is intimately involved with that, and he serves on a working committee. And once that's done, we could potentially then contract with other wastewater agencies, with laboratories in the county, to kind of be like a contract lab for them versus them hiring like a Caltest or another lab. So those are kind of like the summary of the main objectives.
I have one quick question. What is the definition of a volatile solid?
It's the solids that can be digested and converted into energy or other products. That's my kind of.
Okay.
So you have a total solids, and that might be. So you have a material, and its total solids is 79%. The rest are inerts. Then you have a certain amount that's volatile that can be converted to, you know, say like energy through the anaerobic digestion process. So like in the study, we want to figure out what that maximum volatile solids loading is for the organic waste in relation to the wastewater solids. And what's unfortunate for us is there's very little growth or development in the service area, so the wastewater solids, volatile solids loading, won't increase much over time. So as we bring in more organic material, that loading percentage increases, could be fat pretty quickly, and we got to figure out what that line is on a pilot scale where we can have a problem with the digesters.
Has anyone done it yet? So who else is out there doing it besides East Bay Mud and us?
The food organic waste.
Yeah. The study loading up the digesters like that?
Well, East Bay Mud has a lot of extra digesters.
Yeah.
So they have just digesters that they can just, you know, process the food waste and organic material in. They don't have to worry about, you know, the co-digesting like we do. So they're a different situation. And I know, like, City of Los Angeles has a lot of extra digesters. They've dedicated a couple digesters just for, you know, testing of, you know, organic waste, you know, digestion and biogas production and stuff. You know, I participated in this, you know, Water Environment Federation and also an EPA, you know, national webinar about our program. And there's only, you know, like a handful of other agencies that had successful operating programs, but this was about a year ago. There's a lot of agencies that receive fat, oils, and grease for anaerobic digestion, but it's very few that actually receive the food waste because the contamination is the big issue, making sure the material is essentially contaminant-free.
Thank you. Very bad. I have
a question about the debt issuance. Maybe because I'm not on the finance committee, but I've like completely lost track of what the justification for that is. What is the plan? We're issuing debt in 2 years?
The plan is that we have, what is it, $49 million worth of projects coming up in 10 years.
Okay.
And we're going to finance as many as we can, pay as you go, reasonably.
Right.
And we are also going to have some debt. So the plan is to figure out when we need to issue debt, when our pay-as-you-go goes in the hole, you know, or we never want to go in the hole. We always want to have at least a couple of million reserve. Mm-hmm. And if we've got $2 million in the bank and a $9 million project, then we better issue debt. Or we postpone the projects.
Right.
We have a 10-year CIP.
The whole CIP, but did we decide we're going to do this in fiscal year 20, or is that our estimate at the time?
Estimate from now, and I know we're going to look at it. We might plan it this year.
Yeah, the whole revenue plan 5-year structure was built around bringing enough revenues to cover, you know, the debt service costs, assuming a debt service in FY20 that had a 25-year term and such a percentage interest rate.
Oh, so that is baked in?
It's all baked into the plan,
okay.
Yeah.
This is baked in, okay.
I think we have two issuances.
One is in the last year of the plan.
And then we'll see if we need them or not.
Yeah.
And what was the interest rate that you...
It was more than...
It was like 3.6% or 3.8%, something like that.
Okay,
I don't remember exactly.
I thought it was a little more than that.
Could have been, yeah.
I can't remember.
Something like that. I know we went a little high just because we didn't interest rates.
Yeah. And interest rates have increased.
And they made more. So
that's true.
Yeah.
This was all in the discussion, too, about we were leveling rate increases, too, and trying to keep them right at a slightly above CPI, and we had to do this to level all the rate increases.
And it
might be that we have to postpone a $2 million project for 2 years or something like that. That's exactly the key one. Major CIP program like this.
Right.
Yeah, so the key, I'm just looking at the 10-year financial forecast here.
I think it was three of them.
It was designed for FY20 because there's a lot of columns here. I'm going to look at this in a while.
We had a cash flow.
So the capital program in fiscal year 21 has $7 million, and in fiscal year 22 it has $8 million.
Okay.
So if you issue the debt in 20, have the proceeds, reimburse the agency for design costs and stuff associated with some of those projects to refund our reserves, then have the pool of money for the major projects in FY 22 and 23.
Okay, so this is completely consistent with our plan. Thank you all for reminding me.
I wasn't sliding it into the business plan.
In 2 years?
We are going to decide that.
Yeah.
Then we're going to plan it, but we're going to look it over carefully.
Yeah, we'll look at it real close.
I have a question. Is any other wastewater agency going to implement the environmental laboratory accreditation standard? Any other, like Novato or Los Angeles?
So every environmental laboratory has to comply with those standards if they're doing the laboratory analyses at their own laboratory. So contract labs will do it, and larger wastewater agencies will do it, but what's likely going to happen is very small laboratories private ones, or even small public agency laboratories will see that as cost prohibitive, and it's just more economical for them to just send all of their samples out versus hire more staff and increase, you know, their rates to hire the staff so they can, you know, implement and then administer, you know, the new standards.
So our enhanced laboratory information programs and the new lab tech and our very sophisticated lab manager enable us that maybe we can, you know, provide the services for other agencies as well.
Yeah, so this next year we'll have, more detailed discussions with some of the smaller, agencies with labs that are in the county, like Sausalito Marin City Sanitary District, Tiburon Sanitary District, the sewage agency, Southern Marin, Los Salinas, and Veolia runs, Novato's, and they're definitely going to get certified, as a private entity probably. So we'll have, we've had some initial conversations with them at our monthly manager meeting a few months ago, and some of the agencies said that sounds like a good idea, but they have to do their own, cost benefit analysis. Sure. For us, it was more economical to hire a staff person versus send out all the analyses to the contract laboratory based on the costs, last fiscal year we did the analysis. I think we ended up saving on an annual basis, even at the lab analyst top step at the time, I think it was maybe $20,000 or $30,000 a year. We'd be in the black by hiring a staff person versus sending all the lab analyses out. Then we figured in the future if we can bring in some revenues, that's even better.
Any other questions? Would any member of the public like to speak to this? Okay. Let's bring it back for comments. I just had one quick comment. I want to thank Kate. Once again, it's visually very attractive and easy to read, so thank you.
I think there's a lot of tasks here.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, I was... And Jason, we were talking about it... promote interagency coordination. It's 4-2. And the treatment plant managers are not going to meet. And I asked him about that. The managers already meet, but now this is the treatment plant. It's your senior operator.
We use that term because Chris is his title is treatment plant manager. Oh. Maybe we should change this where it's, the chief operator.
Oh, I know that.
You have a chief operator, which is, a certification or a designation, regulatory designation. You have a chief plant operator, and those are the people that are going to be getting together. We just call that person here in their classification the treatment plant manager. So they hold the chief plant operator, title also.
But do you managers already meet?
Well, yeah, the agency managers meet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the treatment plant manager is usually someone that reports to the agency manager or the district manager.
Yeah. And that's probably really good that I think I share ideas.
We should probably change it to chief plant operator. That's kind of more of a regulatory term. That's the intent, is getting operational, the people in charge of operations together to talk about operational matters, process control issues, pilot studies, things like that. What do you guys think? Chief plant operator?
Yeah, which would be accurate.
Yeah, it's more accurate.
Okay. All right, if there are no more comments or questions, anybody want to move approval of this with the change that Jason just noted?
There's one more change that we discovered about 6:35, and I did. And that's under Goal 6, Objective 1.2, the last two actions. The second action says, coordinate 457 plan provider training on the agency's deferred compensation ad programs, because we have multiple ones. And then the last action is prepare a benefit training schedule and begin staff training. So there's just a few kind of, through all the editing and wordsmithing of, the proposed plan, a couple things changed inadvertently.
All right. Would anybody like to move this item with those edits that Jason just described?
I would like to move this item with the edits as Jason just described.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Do I hear a second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Tom.
The agency business plan.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to agenda item number 8, reject all bids for the pavement rehabilitation project.
So we weren't happy about this. But, you know, so, you know, we brought the contract documents to the board. They were accepted, and you authorized the public bidding in May. We went through the whole public bidding process, and we only received one bid from July Brothers down the street. And it was quite a bit higher, 117% higher than what we have as an engineer's estimate. And we used the engineer's estimate to, you know, create, you know, budget account amount for the CIP for this year. The amount, the engineer, that was $190,000. The CIP amount, I think, is $200,000. And the low bid was $412,000. So we were a little surprised by that. But we understand it's kind of a challenging, you know, construction season right now with a lot of things going on in the county and in Sonoma County, especially in the fire, you know, ravaged areas. So there were quite a few contractors that attended the pre-bid, you know, conference and tour. So first we called, you know, engineering staff contacted, you know, the Gelati Brothers, you know, estimator. And he didn't explain why his estimate was so high, but he did say that on several recent projects that were associated with, you know, public agency paving jobs, that they were the lone bidder on the projects. Then we contacted, you know, most of the general contractors that attended the pre-bid, you know, conference and tour, and they said on the same day there were several larger paving projects, you know, around the county, and they decided to, you know, do their estimating and prepare their bid proposals for those projects instead of our project. So that kind of explained why we only had one bidder. So our recommendation is to reject the bid, but in contract law, you say all bids. And then what we'll probably do is, our plan would be to remove out the painting work around the maintenance building, where there's a big, you know, kind of a gap between the pile supported concrete structures and the existing pavement. You know, take that out, fill in some voids, provide some new slopes, remove the trip hazard around the building's, you know, structure. Bid that out informally, which we can do under the Uniform Public Construction Cost Accounting Act, and hopefully have a awarded contract in August and get that work done. And then toward the end of the construction season, when the jobs are, you know, wrapping up, prepare a new bid package with the other paving elements and put that out to bid, probably, you know, in January with the bid opening in March, and then include some money in the fiscal year 20 paving budget for the balance of the work. So that's kind of what the plan is. But tonight, we're just recommending that you reject all the bids.
Okay. Any questions?
Yeah, you're going to just negotiate, and because of what, it's less than $25,000 or something like that?
So under the Uniform Public Construction Cost Accounting Act, our signature authority for self-performing the work or just hiring someone to come in and do it is $45,000. Informally bid, there's a whole process to go through that where you maintain lists of contractors by different, you know, specialties or licenses. You have up to $175,000, you know, authorization. So we could bring someone in under informally bid contract, and we don't have the same prescriptive requirements for the public bidding process as we do under a formally bid. And anything over 175 is formal bid. That's where you have to have, you know, detailed plans and specifications, and you have to advertise, and your bid opening has to be 30 days after the beginning date of advertisement. So we're hoping we can get, you know, the maintenance building paving done and a small area of kind of failed paving by the headworks near the Ross Valley Interceptor done for what's in the budget, and within that $175,000 informal bid limit. And if it's, you know, if it's, I think under the UPCCA regulations, it can be 10% more than that, then the board would award it. Mm-hmm. So we'll package that up, send it out. I've asked, you know, one of our engineering staff to contact every paving contractor on the informal bid list and anyone else that had done work here in the past. So we have a pretty good, you know, list of small to medium-sized contractors. All the four Gelati firms, plus, like, you know, W.R. Ford and Thornton Paving and McClellan and a few others. So we'll contact them personally and just tell them about the job and that we're going to have the documents available. We can email them to them and just have more of an informal process.
And maybe outreach even further to maybe there's some new companies out there.
Yeah.
Because we're seeing the same thing at City of San Rafael. The bids are coming in. These numbers are not improving. So you might have to get a little outside of the box, because we don't want to have to pay very, very high prices as well.
Yeah, it turns out that the work around the maintenance building, a lot of it, you know, concrete cutting, well, you know, asphalt cutting, you know, digging things out with the backhoe, things that a general contractor can do. So you can probably get a general contractor to do this, then they'll have a sub, you know, to come in and just do the small amount of paving, which is, you know, strip out this big around the perimeter of the building. But a lot of it, any contractor can do, the demolition work and the off-hauling and all that, and bringing in all the gravel to fill in the voids under the building because of the soil subsidence.
Did your engineer's estimate change at all given the new bidding environment with what's going on around here? Should we be upping our numbers and being a little more realistic? I mean, are they coming in like $20 a square foot now?
Oh, it's a lot higher than that.
Is that the real cost though now of paving it?
We added a lot of extra contingency in. And I don't know how, I saw the numbers that we had in the bid proposal. We have different items. So we had, you know, cut this stuff out, you know, put in so many, you know, tons of asphalt, what's the unit price? And we have, you know, we have this task order based agreement with this retired, you know, construction management fellow, Isaac D. And we bring Isaac in for special projects. So he's helping out, you know, like on this project and, you know, doing all the FEMA repair work up on the hill up here. And he did his own cost estimate after the bids were open, and he used a really generous, you know, paving number for these tons of asphalt, you know, unit cost. And it was still, you know, I think it was like $260,000 was his estimate. And he didn't see how the number could be higher than that. So I think it was just a lot of just, you know, contractors, they think it's a certain environment. They won't do a really close cost estimate and take off. They'll just put a lot of, you know, contingency in there and profit. And if they get the job, great for them from their perspective, mm-hmm. not from us, our perspective. I think Isaac used like $600 a ton. But they used $600 a ton, and Isaac had like, you know, $300 a ton. And we had, you know, like, you know, 180 or something like that, which we thought was really high compared to the per ton cost for other jobs that were done here just in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. But those are just approximations. I don't remember all the exact figures. But it's,
okay. Can I ask for public comment?
Does the board have to reject these bids?
Yeah, the board has to, yeah.
I move we reject all bids.
Second. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you.
Okay, I'll let you know how the informal bid project goes.
Yes, good luck. Agenda item 9, cancel the September board meeting and reschedule the August board meeting.
So for the last 6 to 7 years, the board has canceled the August board meeting. It has become kind of, you know, a routine thing. We just schedule activities around, you know, the August meeting being canceled. This year, a couple factors came into play, you know, staff vacation schedules, you know, and some other things where we're looking at now having an August meeting and canceling the September meeting. So one recommendation is to cancel the September meeting. In regards to the August meeting is on Tuesday the 14th. We started looking at that date. The CASA conference is the prior week. So that complicates getting the agenda together and out in time. And then one of the primary topics for presentation and discussion at the August meeting is the agency facilities master plan. So Rick Chan from Coral Engineers would come in, and I met with him last Friday to kind of scope it out, and he'd give the presentation to the board with the key findings of the 10 tasks. And he's not here the prior week. So rescheduling the meeting to the 21st or the 23rd, it helps with our obligations to go to the CASA conference because, you know, we're on the board for a couple, you know, organizations there, and helps with Rick Chan's schedule. But I did check in with all the board members independently, and as of last week, everybody was available on the 21st or the 23rd.
And I would like to amend my availability to be limited to the 21st.
Okay.
It's Tuesday.
Yeah.
Right, on the Tuesday. I can't do the Thursday.
Okay. Any member of the public like to speak to this? Thank you. All right.
Move the staff recommendation.
Well, the staff recommendation is either or, but it's considering Mary Beth's.
20.
Yeah.
I'd like to honor Mary Beth and have her present on the 21st of August when it's all here.
All right. But I think
amend the motion to make it August 21st.
Thank you.
Dean, second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Agenda item number 10, North Bay Watershed Association. As I mentioned earlier, there was no meeting last Friday due to the July 4th holiday. The meeting will be this Friday, and I presume we will get a report from Michael next meeting. Thank you. So, moving on, oral reports by commissioners. Anybody have anything? All right, general manager, care to discuss the bullet you found on the...
Yeah. So staff found a bullet on the primary clarifier deck. So went over and talked with the range master over at the shooting range at San Quentin State Prison, and they said, yeah, that's one of our bullets.
Yeah.
And so they're performing an investigation over there.
Are they?
Yeah. And we also notified Santa Rafael Police Department because we're within their jurisdiction and they're participating in the investigation. So we explained, you know, really stressed to... Because they have an indoor shooting range that you can see from Sir Francis Drake, and above that there's an outdoor shooting range. And from the staff that we looked at, they said there's a lot of protections, you know, for people to be able to pick, you know, pull the gun up and shoot. But when you shoot the target, there's some things lacking behind that maybe. The staff that went out there were in the military, and they did have a lot of experience, you know, shooting ranges. But we stressed to them that, you know, we have, you know, a lot of staff that walk around, you know, the agency in 24 hours. You know, we don't want stray bullets flying over the hill from your shooting range. You know, that's primary. And then secondary, we have these two, you know, very expensive digester covers that could get punctured by a bullet and vent biogas and be a huge, you know, cost to drain that system and repair the cover and everything. They took it very seriously and said, we're going to look into this and make sure this doesn't happen again.
Don't they think somebody was... I mean, wouldn't it be pretty hard to... have a bullet ricochet up and over? It was probably somebody just shooting. Did they say anything about that?
Yeah, they didn't. Their eyes on how it could have happened.
Will they be presenting us with a formal written report?
I am not quite sure what they're planning to do at the conclusion of their investigation, but we could definitely ask.
I think we should ask. Yeah. This is an unacceptable breach of, among other things, the law. Yeah. But this is a safety violation. So, full written report. We want to know that policies and procedures and protocols have been changed.
Okay.
Over there.
That's all often trouble me having my shooting range director on major thoroughfare and the village around, we're around. It's just very, it's an accident waiting to happen. I don't know why that thing still exists there.
Yeah, they had another shooting range that was a little closer to the Marine Country Mart, where the Roswell Interceptor goes through the hill, and we have some facilities out there. It was an outdoor shooting range. And I had heard, you know, in the past that we'd find bullets every once in a while on our property. And even one story was that a bullet was all the way over down Bellum, over by George Lucas. Used to have some property out there where they did filming. I think where the Vicente's Mexican restaurant is now. So that one's been shut down. And now they built the indoor range, but now they have an outdoor range.
I think we're said in San Francisco there's a shooting range. Mm-hmm. I think they've shut it down, but every year when we did the AIDS ride, you're coming down the backside and around Lake Merced, shooting, and there are bullets.
This is shocking.
So how did they find it? I mean, they just saw us.
They just slid. Yeah, slid there. Yeah.
Was it in real good shape? Like...
It was. I didn't see it.
Because that means it didn't ricochet.
No, if it wasn't splattered.
It was fired over.
But it was in good enough condition that the range master identified it as something that they use as their ammo there.
Yeah, get the range master over in for some training. Okay.
Then just three things real quick. Our technical services manager recruitment to close on the 2nd. We have, you know, a list of good candidates, so we'll be selecting, you know, individuals for interviews later this week, and hopefully our first interviews end of July and someone on board in early September. So that's kind of the plan. The safety manager recruitment, that's in the program that we have with the Water Sanitary District. We had a second interview with top candidate last week, and we have one tomorrow afternoon with facility tour. And both the two top candidates are great, and they're, you know, they're experienced. One lives in Novato, and one lives in San Rafael. So that's great news also. Then just on the back here, some photos of the paving project. And this up in the top there, so we have this like 6,000 gallon ferric chloride tank out by our digesters. It was one of the first projects I worked on here back in 1993. It was building this containment area. A design engineer designed it. A contractor came in, put in the tank and the piping system. Well, after 25 years, you know, the tank's been affected by, you know, the ferric chloride. So our staff constructed a temporary dosing system in a nearby room. They drained everything out of the tank, and then they took the tank to the front of the plant. They flushed it out and bled everything into the plant, and they've cut that up and had it disposed of. And then they've removed all the piping system, and you see the second picture is the concrete pad. They rehabilitated all the concrete. They put a protective epoxy coating on it. Then we bought another tank, and we set the tank in place. We installed, you know, the seismic restraint system and a much cleaner piping system in the last photo four. So I just wanted to highlight, you know, the good work of the maintenance staff.
Yeah, and the design improvement. Visually, it looks great.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really clean installation.
Yeah, good job.
They heard all the complaints with operators for all the years and said, we're going to address all of those. Okay. Darn engineers built into the system back in 1993.
What would have that engineer?
What is a ferric tank?
It's a tank that handles stores ferric chloride, and that's a iron salt chemical is used for at that location. It's used for two purposes. One is to dose a little ferric chloride into the digesters to react with hydrogen sulfide gas that's produced in the digestion process by some of the microbes. So that kind of binds that up and keeps it, you know, as precipitates, and then use the ferric. And you inject that into the digestive sludge pipelines that feed the centrifuges, and that acts as what conditions the sludge in combinations with the polymer that we add. It acts as a flocculant and coagulant to increase the dewatering of the biosolids.
Interesting.
I want to put that on a t-shirt. Ferric increases flocculant and coagulant.
That's all I have.
Thank you.
Just a comment on one of the letters, EPA to begin new rulemaking process for blending. And I can't imagine that the new EPA is going to get more strict on blending. So maybe that'll get less strict. You know, I mean, it has a huge impact on us. Or this paper, you couldn't tell.
Well, it could also be that those in top management and EPA don't understand this stuff. So.
You're seeing a pattern.
It's too much for Scott Pruitt. So.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that they'll. The coal industry lobbyists are getting more strict on blending. But maybe that's just me.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
If there's money in it, they'll figure it out.
Thank you all. Next meeting is August 21st. See you then.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.